Chapter 28. How to Keep from Worrying About Insomnia. Do you worry when you can't sleep well? Then it may interest you to know that Samuel Untermeyer, the famous international lawyer, never got a decent night's sleep in his life. When Sam Untermeyer went to college, he worried about two afflictions, asthma and insomnia. He couldn't seem to cure either, so he decided to do the next best thing, take advantage of his wakefulness. Instead of tossing and turning and worrying himself into a breakdown, he'd get up and study. The result? He began ticking off honors in all of his classes and became one of the prodigies of the College of the City of New York. Even after he started to practice law, his insomnia continued, but Untermeyer didn't worry. Nature, he said, will take care of me. Nature did. In spite of the small amount of sleep he was getting, his health kept up and he was able to work as hard as any of the young lawyers of the New York bar. He even worked harder, for he worked while they slept. At the age of 21, Sam Untermeyer was earning $75,000 a year, and other young attorneys rushed to courtrooms to study his methods. In 1931, he was paid for handling one case what was at that time probably the highest lawyer's fee ever paid, a cool $1 million cash on the barrelhead. Still, he had insomnia, read half the night, then got up at 5 a.m. and started dictating letters. By the time most people were just starting work, his day's work would be almost half done. He lived to the age of 81, this man who had rarely had a sound night's sleep. But if he fretted and worried about his insomnia, he probably would have wrecked his life. We spend a third of our lives sleeping, yet nobody knows what sleep really is. We know it's a habit and a state of rest in which nature knits up the raveled sleeve of care, but we don't know how many hours of sleep each individual requires. We don't even know if we have to sleep at all. Fantastic. Well, during the First World War, Paul Kern, a Hungarian soldier, was shot through the frontal lobe of his brain. He recovered from the wound, but curiously enough, he couldn't fall asleep. No matter what the doctors did, and they tried all kinds of sedatives and narcotics, even hypnotism, Paul Kern couldn't be put to sleep or even made to feel drowsy. The doctors said he wouldn't live long, but he fooled them. He got a job and went on living in the best of health for years. He would lie down and close his eyes and rest, but he got no sleep whatever. His case was a medical mystery that upset many of our beliefs about sleep. Some people require far more sleep than others. Toscanini needed only 5 hours a night, but Calvin Coolidge needed more than twice that much. Coolidge slept 11 hours out of every 24. In other words, Toscanini slept away approximately one-fifth of his life, while Coolidge slept away almost half of his life. Worrying about insomnia will hurt you far more than insomnia. For example, one of my students, Ira Sandner of Ridgefield Park, New Jersey, was driven nearly to suicide by chronic insomnia. "I actually thought I was going insane," Ira Sandner told me. "The trouble was, in the beginning, that I was too sound a sleeper. I wouldn't wake up when the alarm clock went off, and the result was that I was getting to work late in the morning. I worried about it, and in fact my boss warned me that I would have to get to work on time. I knew that if I kept oversleeping, I'd lose my job. I told my friends about it, and one of them suggested I concentrate hard on the alarm clock before I went to sleep. That started the insomnia. The tick, tick, tick of that blasted alarm clock became an obsession. It kept me awake, tossing all night long. When morning came, I was almost ill. I was ill from fatigue and worry. This kept on for 8 weeks. I can't put into words the tortures I suffered. I was convinced I was going insane. Sometimes I paced the floor for hours at a time, and I honestly considered jumping out of the window and ending the whole thing. At last, I went to a doctor I had known all my life. He said, 'Ira, I can't help you. No one can help you, because you've brought this thing on yourself. Go to bed nights, and if you can't fall asleep, forget all about it. Just say to yourself, I don't care a hang if I don't go to sleep. It's all right with me if I lie awake till morning. Keep your eyes closed and say, as long as I just lie still and don't worry about it, I'll be getting rest anyway.' 'I did that,' says Santner, 'and in 2 weeks' time I was dropping off to sleep. In less than 1 month, I was sleeping 8 hours, and my nerves were back to normal. It wasn't insomnia that was killing Ira Sandner. It was his worry about it. Dr. Nathaniel Kleitman, professor at the University of Chicago, had done more research work on sleep than had any other living man. An expert on sleep, he declared that he had never known anyone to die from insomnia. To be sure, a man might worry about insomnia until he lowered his vitality and was swept away by germs, but it was the worry that did the damage, not the insomnia itself. Dr. Kleitman also said that the people who worry about insomnia usually sleep far more than they realize. The man who swears, "I never slept a wink last night," may have slept for hours without knowing it. For example, one of the most profound thinkers of the 19th century, Herbert Spencer, was an old bachelor, lived in a boarding house, and bored everyone with his talk about his insomnia. He even put stoppings in his ears to keep out the noise and quiet his nerves. Sometimes he took opium to induce sleep. One night, he and Professor Sacy of Oxford shared the same room at a hotel, and the next morning Spencer declared he hadn't slept a wink all night. In reality, it was Professor Sacy who hadn't slept a wink. He'd been kept awake all night by Spencer's snoring. The first requisite for a good night's sleep is a feeling of security. We need to feel that some power greater than ourselves will take care of us until morning. Dr. Thomas Hyslop of the Great West Riding Asylum stressed that point in an address before the British Medical Association. He said, "One of the best sleep-producing agents which my years of practice have revealed to me is prayer. I say this purely as a medical man." The exercise of prayer, in those who habitually exert it, must be regarded as the most adequate and normal of all the pacifiers of the mind and calmer of the nerves. Let God and let go. Jeanette MacDonald told me that when she was depressed and worried and had difficulty in going to sleep, she could always get a feeling of security by repeating Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters." But if you're not religious and have to do things the hard way, then learn to relax by physical measures. Dr. David Harold Fink, who wrote Release from Nervous Tension, says that the best way to do this is to talk to your body. According to Dr. Fink, words are the key to all kinds of hypnosis, and when you consistently can't sleep, it's because you've talked yourself into a case of insomnia. The way to undo this is to dehypnotize yourself, and you can do it by saying to the muscles of your body, let go, loosen up and relax. We already know that the mind and the nerves can't relax while the muscles are tense, so if we want to go to sleep, we start with the muscles. Dr. Fink recommends, and it works out in practice, that we put a pillow under the knees to ease the tension of the legs, and that we tuck small pillows under arms for the very same reason. Then, by telling the jaw to relax, the eyes, the arms, and the legs, we finally drop off to sleep before we know what's hit us. I've tried it, I know. One of the best cures for insomnia is making yourself physically tired by gardening, swimming, tennis, golf, skiing, or just plain physically exhausting work. That's what Theodore Dreiser did. When he was a struggling young author, he was worried about insomnia, so he got a job working as a section hand on the New York Central Railway. And after a day of driving spikes and shoveling gravel, he was so exhausted that he could hardly stay awake long enough to eat. If we get tired enough, nature will force us to sleep, even while we're walking. To illustrate, when I was 13 years old, my father shipped a carload of fat hogs to St. Joe, Missouri. Since he got 2 free railroad passes, he took me along with him. Up until that time, I had never seen a town of more than 4,000. When I landed in St. Joe, a city of 60,000, I was so agog with excitement. I saw a skyscraper 6 stories high. And wonder of wonders, I saw a streetcar. I can close my eyes now and still see and hear that streetcar. After the most thrilling and exciting day of my life, Father and I took a train back to Ravenwood, Missouri. Arriving there at 2 o'clock in the morning, we had to walk 4 miles home to the farm. And here's the point of the story. I was so exhausted that I slept and dreamed as I walked. I've often slept while riding horseback, and I'm alive to tell it. When men are completely exhausted, they sleep right through the thunder and horror and danger of war. Dr. Foster Kennedy, the famous neurologist, tells me that during the retreat of the 5th British Army in 1918, he saw soldiers so exhausted that they fell on the ground where they were and fell into a sleep as sound as a coma, and they didn't even wake up when he raised their eyelids with his fingers. And he says he noticed that invariably the pupils of the eyes were rolled upward in the sockets. After that, says Dr. Kennedy, when I had trouble sleeping, I would practice rolling up my eyeballs into this position, and I found that in a few seconds I would begin to yawn and feel sleepy. It was an automatic reflex over which I had no control. No man ever committed suicide by refusing to sleep, and no one ever will. Nature would force a man to sleep in spite of all his willpower. Nature will let us go without food or water far longer than she will let us go without sleep. And speaking of suicide reminds me of a case that Dr. Henry C. Link describes in his book, The Rediscovery of Man. Dr. Link was vice president of the Psychological Corporation, and he interviewed many people who were worried and depressed. In his chapter on overcoming fears and worries, he tells about a patient who wanted to commit suicide. Dr. Link knew arguing would only make the matter worse, so he said to this man, "If you're going to commit suicide anyway, you might at least do it in a heroic fashion. Run around the block until you drop dead." He tried it, not once, but several times, and each time felt better in his mind, if not in his muscles. By the third night, he had achieved what Dr. Link intended in the first place. He was so physically tired and physically relaxed that he slept like a log. Later, he joined an athletic club and began to compete in competitive sport. Soon he was feeling so good he wanted to live forever. So, to keep from worrying about insomnia, here are 5 rules. 1. If you can't sleep, do what Samuel Untermeyer did. Get up and work or read until you do feel sleepy. 2. Remember that no one was ever killed by lack of sleep. Worrying about insomnia usually causes far more damage than sleeplessness. 3. Try prayer, or repeat Psalm 23, as Jeanette MacDonald did. 4. Relax your body. 5. Exercise. Get yourself so physically tired you can't stay awake. Part 7 in a nutshell. 6 ways to prevent fatigue and worry and keep your energy and spirits high. Rule 1. Rest before you get tired. Rule 2. Learn to relax at your work. Rule 3. Learn to relax at home. Rule 4. Apply these 4 good working habits. A. Clear your desk of all papers except those relating to the immediate problem at hand. B. Do things in the order of their importance. C. When you face a problem, solve it, then and there, if you have the facts necessary to make a decision. D. Learn to organize, deputize, and supervise. Rule 5. To prevent worry and fatigue, put enthusiasm into your work. Rule 6. Remember, no one was ever killed by lack of sleep. It is worrying about insomnia that does the damage, not the insomnia. Part 8, How I Conquered Worry, 31 True Stories. 6 Major Troubles Hit Me All at Once, by C.I. Blackwood. In the summer of 1943, it seemed to me that half the worries of the world had come to rest on my shoulders. For more than 40 years, I'd lived a normal, carefree life with only the usual troubles which come to a husband, father, and businessman. I could usually meet these troubles easily, but suddenly, wham, 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 6 major troubles hit me all at once. I pitched and tossed and turned in bed all night long, half dreading to see the day come, because I faced these 6 major worries. One, my business college was trembling on the verge of financial disaster because all the boys were going to war, and most of the girls were making more money working in war plants without training than my graduates could make in business offices with training. Two, my older son was in service, and I had the heart-numbing worry common to all parents whose sons were away at war. Three, Oklahoma City had already started proceedings to condemn a large tract of land for an airport, and my home, formerly my father's home, was located in the center of this tract. I knew that I would be paid only one-tenth of its value, and what was even worse, I would lose my home. And because of the housing shortage, I worried about whether I could possibly find another home to shelter my family of six. I feared we might have to live in a tent. I even worried about whether we would be able to buy a tent. Four, the water well on my property went dry because a drainage canal had been dug near my home. To dig a new well would be throwing $500 away because the land was already being condemned. I had to carry water to my livestock in buckets every morning for 2 months, and I feared I would have to continue it during the rest of the war. Five, I lived 10 miles away from my business school, and I had a Class B gasoline card. That meant I couldn't buy any new tires, so I worried about how I could ever get to work when the superannuated tires on my old Ford gave up the ghost. Six, my eldest daughter had graduated from high school a year ahead of schedule. She had her heart set on going to college, and I just didn't have the money to send her. I knew her heart would be broken. And one afternoon, sitting in my office worrying about my worries, I decided to write them all down, for it seemed no one ever had more worries than I had. I didn't mind wrestling with worries that gave me a fighting chance to solve them, but these worries all seemed to be utterly beyond my control. I could do nothing to solve them. So I filed away this typewritten list of my troubles, and as the months passed, I forgot that I'd ever written it. 18 months later, while transferring my files, I happened to come across this list of my six major problems that had once threatened to wreck my health. I read them with a great deal of interest and profit. I now saw that not one of them had come to pass. Here's what happened to them. One, I saw that all my worries about having to close my business college had been useless, because the government had started paying business schools for training veterans, and my school was soon filled to capacity. Two, I saw that all my worries about my son in service had been useless. He was coming through the war without a scratch. Three, I saw that all my worries about my land being condemned had been useless, because as soon as I knew my land would not be condemned, I spent the money necessary to dig a new well to a deeper level and found an unfailing supply of water. Five, I saw that all my worries about my tires giving out had been useless, because by recapping and careful driving, the tires had managed somehow to survive. Six, I saw that all my worries about my daughter's education had been useless, because just 60 days before the opening of college, I was offered, almost like a miracle, an auditing job which I could do outside of school hours, and this job made it possible for me to send her to college on schedule. I'd often heard people say that 90% of the things we worry and stew and fret about never happen, but this old saying didn't mean much to me until I ran across that list of worries I'd typed out that dreary afternoon 18 months previously. I'm thankful now that I had to wrestle in vain with those six terrible worries. That experience has taught me a lesson I'll never forget. It's shown me the folly and tragedy of stewing about events that haven't happened, events that are beyond our control and may never happen. Remember, today is the tomorrow you worried about yesterday. Ask yourself, how do I know this thing I'm worrying about will really come to pass? I Can Turn Myself into a Shouting Optimist Within an Hour, by Roger W. Babson, famous economist. When I find myself depressed over present conditions, I can, within 1 hour, banish worry and turn myself into a shouting optimist. Here is how I do it. I enter my library, close my eyes, and walk to certain shelves containing only books on history. With my eyes still shut, I reach for a book, not knowing whether I am picking up Prescott's Conquest of Mexico or Suetonius' Lives of the 12 Caesars. With my eyes still closed, I open the book at random. I then open my eyes and read for an hour, and the more I read, the more sharply I realize that the world has always been in the throes of agony, that civilization has always been tottering on the brink. The pages of history fairly shriek with tragic tales of war, famine, poverty, pestilence, and man's inhumanity to man. After reading history for an hour, I realize that bad as conditions are now, they are infinitely better than they used to be. This enables me to see and face my present troubles in their proper perspective, as well as to realize that the world as a whole is constantly growing better. Here is a method that deserves a whole chapter. Read history. Try to get the viewpoint of 10,000 years and see how trivial your troubles are in terms of eternity. How I Got Rid of an Inferiority Complex by Elmer Thomas, former United States Senator from Oklahoma. When I was 15, I was constantly tormented by worries and fears and self-consciousness. I was extremely tall for my age and thin as a fence rail. I stood 6'2" and weighed only 118 pounds. In spite of my height, I was weak and could never compete with the other boys in baseball or running games. They poked fun at me and called me Hatchet Face. I was so worried and self-conscious that I dreaded to meet anyone, and I seldom did, for our farmhouse was off the public road and surrounded by thick virgin timber that had never been cut since the beginning of time. We lived half a mile from the highway, and a week would often go by without my seeing anyone except my mother, father, brothers, and sisters. I would have been a failure in life if I'd let those worries and fears whip me. Every day and every hour of the day, I brooded over my tall, gaunt, weak body. I could hardly think of anything else. My embarrassment, my fear was so intense that it's almost impossible to describe it. My mother knew how I felt. She'd been a school teacher, so she said to me, "Son, you ought to get an education. You ought to make your living with your mind because your body will always be a handicap." Since my parents were unable to send me to college, I knew I'd have to make my own way. So I hunted and trapped opossum, skunk, mink, and raccoon one winter, sold my hides for $4 in the spring, then bought two little pigs with my $4. I fed the pigs slop and later corn and sold them for $40 the next fall. With the proceeds from the sale of the two hogs, I went away to the Central Normal College located in Danville, Indiana. I paid $1.40 a week for my board, 50 cents a week for my room. I wore a brown shirt my mother had made me. Obviously, she used brown cloth because it wouldn't show dirt. I wore a suit of clothes that had once belonged to my father. Dad's clothes didn't fit me, and neither did his old Congress gaiter shoes that I wore, shoes that had elastic bands in the sides that stretched when you put them on. The stretch had long since gone out of the bands, and the tops were so loose the shoes almost dropped off my feet as I walked. I was so embarrassed to associate with the other students, so I sat in my room alone and studied. The deepest desire of my life was to be able to buy some store clothes that fit me, clothes that I was not ashamed of. Shortly after that, four events happened that helped me to overcome my worries and my feeling of inferiority. One of these events gave me courage and hope and confidence and completely changed all the rest of my life. Now, I'll describe these events briefly. First, after attending this normal school for only 8 weeks, I took an examination and was given a third-grade certificate to teach in the country public schools. To be sure, this certificate was good for only 6 months, but it was fleeting evidence that somebody had faith in me. The first evidence of faith that I had ever had from anyone except my mother. A second, a country school board at a place called Happy Hollow hired me to teach at a salary of $2 a day or $40 a month. Now, here was even more evidence of somebody's faith in me. Third, as soon as I got my first check, I bought some store clothes that I wasn't ashamed to wear. If someone gave me $1 million now, it wouldn't thrill me half as much as that first suit of clothes for which I paid only a few dollars. Fourth, the real turning point in my life, the first great victory in my struggle against embarrassment and inferiority, occurred at the Putnam County Fair, held annually in Bainbridge, Indiana. My mother had urged me to enter a public speaking contest that was to be held at the fair. To me, the very idea seemed fantastic. I didn't have the courage to talk to even one person, let alone a crowd. But my mother's faith in me was almost pathetic. She dreamed great dreams for my future. She was living her own life over in her son. Her faith inspired me to enter the contest. I chose for my subject about the last thing in the world that I was qualified to talk on, the fine and liberal arts of America. Frankly, when I began to prepare the speech, I didn't know what the liberal arts were, but it didn't matter much because my audience didn't know either. I memorized my flowery talk and rehearsed it to the trees and cows 100 times. I was so eager to make a good showing for my mother's sake that I must have spoken with emotion. At any rate, I was awarded first prize. I was astounded at what happened. A cheer went up from the crowd. The very boys who'd once ridiculed me and poked fun at me and called me Hatchet Face now slapped me on the back and said, "I knew you could do it, Elmer." My mother put her arms around me and sobbed. As I look back in retrospect, I can see that winning that speaking contest was the turning point of my life. The local newspapers ran an article about me on the front page and prophesied great things for my future. Winning that contest put me on the map locally and gave me prestige, and what's far more important, it multiplied my confidence 100-fold. I now realize that if I'd not won that contest, I probably would never have become a member of the United States Senate, for it lifted my sights, widened my horizons, and made me realize that I had latent abilities that I never dreamed I possessed. Most important, however, was the fact that the first prize in the oratorical contest was a year's scholarship in the Central Normal College. I hungered now for more education, so during the next few years, from 1896 to 1900, I divided my time between teaching and studying. In order to pay my expenses at DePaul University, I waited on tables, looked after furnaces, mowed lawns, kept books, worked in the wheat and corn fields during the summer, and hauled gravel on a public road construction job. In 1896, when I was only 19, I made 28 speeches urging people to vote for William Jennings Bryan for president. The excitement of speaking for Bryan aroused a desire in me to enter politics myself. So when I entered DePaul University, I studied law and public speaking. In 1899, I represented the university in a debate with Butler College, held in Indianapolis, on the subject, resolved that United States senators should be elected by popular vote. Well, I won other speaking contests and became editor-in-chief of the Class of 1900 college annual, The Mirage, and the university paper, The Palladium. After receiving my A.B. degree at DePaul, I took Horace Greeley's advice, only I didn't go west, I went southwest. I went down to a new country, Oklahoma, when the Kiowa, Comanche, and Apache Indian Reservation was opened. I homesteaded a claim and opened a law office in Lawton, Oklahoma. I served in the Oklahoma State Senate for 13 years, in the lower house of Congress for 4 years, and at 50 years of age, I achieved my lifelong ambition. I was elected to the United States Senate from Oklahoma. I've served in that capacity since March 4, 1927. Since Oklahoma and Indian Territories became the state of Oklahoma on November 16, 1907, I have been continuously honored by the Democrats of my adopted state by nominations, first for state senate and for Congress, and later for the United States Senate. I've told this story not to brag about my own feeling of accomplishment, which can't possibly interest anyone else. I've told it wholly with the hope that it may give renewed courage and confidence to some poor boy who's now suffering from the worries and shyness and feeling of inferiority that devastated my life when I was wearing my father's cast-off clothes and gaiter shoes that almost dropped off my feet as I walked. It's interesting to know that Elmer Thomas, who was so ashamed of his ill-fitting clothes as a youth, was later voted the best-dressed man in the United States Senate. I Lived in the Garden of Allah by R.V.C. Bodley, descendant of Sir Thomas Bodley, founder of the Bodleian Library, Oxford, author of Wind in the Sahara, The Messenger, and 14 other volumes. In 1918, I turned my back on the world I had known and went to Northwest Africa and lived with the Arabs in the Sahara, the Garden of Allah. I lived there 7 years. I learned to speak the language of the nomads. I wore their clothes, I ate their food, and adopted their mode of life, which has changed very little during the last 20 centuries. I became an owner of sheep and slept on the ground in the Arabs' tents. I also made a detailed study of their religion. In fact, I later wrote a book about Muhammad entitled The Messenger. Those 7 years which I spent with these wandering shepherds were the most peaceful and contented years of my life. I had already had a rich and varied experience. I was born of English parents in Paris and lived in France for 9 years. Later, I was educated at Eton and at the Royal Military College at Sandhurst. Then I spent 6 years as a British Army officer in India, where I played polo and hunted and explored in the Himalayas, as well as doing some soldiering. I fought through the First World War, and at its close, I was sent to the Paris Peace Conference as an assistant military attaché. I was shocked and disappointed at what I saw there. During the 4 years of slaughter on the Western Front, I had believed we were fighting to save civilization. But at the Paris Peace Conference, I saw selfish politicians laying the groundwork for the Second World War, each country grabbing all it could for itself, creating national antagonisms, and reviving the intrigues of secret diplomacy. I was sick of war, sick of the army, sick of society. For the first time in my career, I spent sleepless nights worrying about what I should do with my life. Lloyd George urged me to go in for politics. I was considering taking his advice when a strange thing happened, a strange thing that shaped and determined my life for the next 7 years. It all came from a conversation with Ted Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, the most colorful and romantic figure produced by the First World War. He had lived in the desert with the Arabs, and he advised me to do the same thing. At first, it sounded fantastic. However, I was determined to leave the army, and I had to do something. Civilian employers did not want to hire men like me, ex-officers of the regular army, especially when the labor market was jammed with millions of unemployed. So I did as Lawrence suggested. I went to live with the Arabs. I'm glad I did so. They taught me how to conquer worry. Like all faithful Muslims, they are fatalists. They believe that every word which Muhammad wrote in the Quran is the divine revelation of Allah. So when the Quran says, God created you and all your actions, they accept it literally. That is why they take life so calmly and never hurry or get into unnecessary tempers when things go wrong. They know that what is ordained is ordained, and no one but God can alter anything. However, that doesn't mean that in the face of disaster, they sit down and do nothing. To illustrate, let me tell you of a fierce, burning windstorm of the Scirocco, which I experienced when I was living in the Sahara. It howled and screamed for 3 days and nights. It was so strong, so fierce, that it blew sand from the Sahara hundreds of miles across the Mediterranean and sprinkled it over the Rhone Valley in France. The wind was so hot, I felt as if the hair was being scorched off my head. My throat was parched, my eyes burned, my teeth were full of grit. I felt as if I were standing in front of a furnace at a glass factory. I was driven as near crazy as a man can be and retain his sanity. But the Arabs didn't complain. They shrugged their shoulders and said, Maktub, it is written. But immediately after the storm was over, they sprang into action. They slaughtered all the lambs because they knew they would die anyway, and by slaughtering them at once, they hoped to save the mother sheep. After the lambs were slaughtered, the flocks were driven southward to water. This was all done calmly, without worry or complaining or mourning over their losses. The tribal chief said, It is not too bad. We might have lost everything, but praise God, we have 40% of our sheep left to make a new start. I remember another occasion when we were motoring across the desert and a tire blew out. The chauffeur had forgotten to mend the spare tire, so there we were with only three tires. I fussed and fumed and got excited and asked the Arabs what we were going to do. They reminded me that getting excited wouldn't help, that it only made one hotter. The blown-out tire, they said, was the will of Allah, and nothing could be done about it. So we started on, crawling along on the rim of a wheel. Presently, the car sputtered and stopped. We were out of gas. The chief merely remarked, "Maktoub," and there again, instead of shouting at the driver because he had not taken on enough gas, everyone remained calm, and we walked to our destination, singing as we went. The 7 years I spent with the Arabs convinced me that the neurotics, the insane, the drunks of America and Europe are the product of the hurried and harassed lives we live in our so-called civilization. As long as I lived in the Sahara, I had no worries. I found there, in the Garden of Allah, the serene contentment and physical well-being that so many of us are seeking with tenseness and despair. Many people scoff at fatalism. Maybe they're right, who knows? But all of us must be able to see how our fates are often determined for us. For example, if I had not spoken to Lawrence of Arabia at 3 minutes past noon on a hot August day in 1919, all the years that have elapsed since then would have been completely different. Looking back over my life, I can see how it has been shaped and molded time and again by events far beyond my control. The Arabs call it Maktoub, Kismet, the will of Allah. Call it anything you wish. It does strange things to you. I only know that today, 17 years after leaving the Sahara, I still maintain that happy resignation to the inevitable which I learned from the Arabs. That philosophy has done more to settle my nerves than 1,000 sedatives could have achieved. When the fierce burning winds blow over our lives and we cannot prevent them, let us too accept the inevitable, and then get busy and pick up the pieces. 5 methods I have used to banish worry by Professor William Lyon Phelps. I had the privilege of spending an afternoon with Billy Phelps of Yale shortly before his death. Now, here are the 5 methods he used to banish worry based on the notes I took during that interview. And number 1. When I was 24 years old, my eyes suddenly gave out. After reading 3 or 4 minutes, my eyes felt as if they were full of needles. And even when I was not reading, they were so sensitive that I could not face a window. I consulted the best oculist in New Haven and New York. Nothing seemed to help me. After 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I simply sat in a chair in the darkest corner of the room, waiting for bedtime. I was terrified. I feared that I would have to give up my career as a teacher and go out west and get a job as a lumberjack. Then a strange thing happened, which shows the miraculous effects of the mind over physical ailments. When my eyes were at their worst that unhappy winter, I accepted an invitation to address a group of undergraduates. The hall was illuminated by huge rings of gas jets suspended from the ceiling. The lights pained my eyes so intensely that while sitting on the platform, I was compelled to look at the floor. Yet during my 30-minute speech, I felt absolutely no pain, and I could look directly at these lights without any blinking whatever. Then, when the assembly was over, my eyes pained me again. I thought then that if I could keep my mind strongly concentrated on something, not for 30 minutes, but for a week, I might be cured. For clearly, it was a case of mental excitement triumphing over a bodily illness. I had a similar experience later, while crossing the ocean. I had an attack of lumbago so severe that I could not walk. I suffered extreme pain when I tried to stand up straight. While in that condition, I was invited to give a lecture on shipboard. As soon as I began to speak, every trace of pain and stiffness left my body. I stood up straight, moved about with perfect flexibility, and spoke for an hour. When the lecture was over, I walked away to my stateroom with ease. For a moment I thought I was cured, but the cure was only temporary. the lumbago resumed its attack. These experiences demonstrated to me the vital importance of one's mental attitude. They taught me the importance of enjoying life while you may. So I live every day now as if it were the first day I had ever seen and the last I were going to see. I'm excited about the daily adventure of living, and nobody in a state of excitement will be unduly troubled with worries. I love my daily work as a teacher. I wrote a book entitled The Excitement of Teaching. Teaching has always been more than an art or an occupation to me. It is a passion. I love to teach as a painter loves to paint or a singer loves to sing. Before I get out of bed in the morning, I think with ardent delight of my first group of students. I have always felt that one of the chief reasons for success in life is enthusiasm. Number two, I have found that I can crowd worry out of my mind by reading an absorbing book. When I was 59, I had a prolonged nervous breakdown. During that period, I began reading David Alec Wilson's monumental Life of Carlyle. It had a good deal to do with my convalescence because I became so absorbed in reading it that I forgot my despondency. Number three. At another time, when I was terribly depressed, I forced myself to become physically active almost every hour of the day. I played five or six sets of violent games of tennis every morning, then took a bath, had lunch, played 18 holes of golf every afternoon. On Friday nights, I danced until 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm a great believer in working up a tremendous sweat. I found that depression and worry oozed out of my system with the sweat. Number four, I learned long ago to avoid the folly of hurry, rush, and working under tension. I've always tried to apply the philosophy of Wilbur Cross. When he was governor of Connecticut, he said to me, "Sometimes when I have too many things to do all at once, I sit down and relax and smoke my pipe for an hour and do nothing." Number five, I have also learned that patience and time have a way of resolving our troubles. When I'm worried about something, I try to see my troubles in their proper perspective. I say to myself, 2 months from now, I shall not be worrying about this bad break, so why worry about it now? Why not assume now the same attitude that I will have 2 months from now? To sum up, here are the five ways in which Professor Phelps banished worry. 1. Live with gusto and enthusiasm. I live every day as if it were the first day I have ever seen and the last I were going to see. 2. Read an interesting book. When I had a prolonged nervous breakdown, I began reading The Life of Carlyle and became so absorbed in reading that I forgot my despondency. 3. Play games. When I was terribly depressed, I forced myself to become physically active almost every hour of the day. 4. Relax while you work. I long ago learned to avoid the folly of hurry, rush, and working under tension. 5. I try to see my troubles in their proper perspective. I say to myself, 2 months from now, I shall not be worrying about this bad break, so why worry about it now? Why not assume now the same attitude that I will have 2 months from now? I Stood Yesterday, I Can Stand Today, by Dorothy Dix. I've been through the depths of poverty and sickness. When people ask me what's kept me going through all the troubles that come to all of us, I always reply, I stood yesterday, I can stand today, and I will not permit myself to think about what might happen tomorrow. I have known want and struggle and anxiety and despair. I've always had to work beyond the limit of my strength. As I look back upon my life, I see it as a battlefield strewn with the wrecks of dead dreams and broken hopes and shattered illusions, a battle in which I always fought with the odds tremendously against me, and which has left me scarred and bruised and maimed and old before my time. Yet I have no pity for myself, no tears to shed over the past and gone sorrows, no envy for the women who have been spared all I've gone through, for I have lived, they only existed. I have drunk the cup of life down to its very dregs. They have only sipped the bubbles on top of it. I know things they will never know. I see things to which they are blind. It is only the women whose eyes have been washed clear with tears who get the broad vision that makes them little sisters to all the world. I have learned in the great University of Hard Knocks a philosophy that no woman who has had an easy life ever acquires. I have learned to live each day as it comes, not to borrow trouble by dreading the morrow. It is the dark menace of the picture that makes cowards of us. I put that dread from me because experience has taught me that when the time comes that I so fear, the strength and wisdom to meet it will be given me. Little annoyances no longer have the power to affect me. After you've seen your whole edifice of happiness topple and crash in ruins about you, it never matters to you again that a servant forgets to put the doilies under the finger bowls or the cook spills the soup. I have learned not to expect too much of people, and so I can still get happiness out of the friend who isn't quite true to me or the acquaintance who gossips. Above all, I have acquired a sense of humor, because there were so many things over which I had either to cry or laugh. And when a woman can joke over her troubles instead of having hysterics, nothing can ever hurt her much again. I do not regret the hardships I have known, because through them I have touched life at every point I have lived, and it was worth the price I had to pay. Dorothy Dix conquered worry by living in day-tight compartments. I Did Not Expect to Live to See the Dawn by J.C. Penney. On April 14, 1902, a young man with $500 in cash and $1 million in determination opened a dry goods store in Kemmerer, Wyoming, a little mining town of 1,000 people situated on the old covered wagon trail laid out by the Lewis and Clark expedition. That young man and his wife lived in a half-story attic above the store, using a large empty dry goods box for a table and smaller boxes for chairs. The young wife wrapped her baby in a blanket and let it sleep under a counter while she stood beside it, helping her husband wait on customers. Today, the largest chain of dry goods stores in the world bears that man's name, the J.C. Penney stores, over 1,600 of them covering every state in the Union. I recently had dinner with Mr. Penney, and he told me about the most dramatic moment of his life. Years ago, I passed through a most trying experience. I was worried and desperate. My worries were not connected in any way whatever with the J.C. Penney Company, and that business was solid and thriving. But I personally had made some unwise commitments prior to the crash of 1929. Like many other men, I was blamed for conditions for which I was in no way responsible. I was so harassed with worries that I couldn't sleep, and developed an extremely painful ailment known as the shingles, a red rash and skin eruptions. I consulted a physician, a man with whom I'd gone to high school as a boy in Hamilton, Missouri, Dr. Elmer Eggleston, a staff physician at the Kellogg Sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan. Dr. Eggleston put me to bed and warned me that I was a very ill man. A rigid treatment was prescribed, but nothing helped. I got weaker day by day. I was broken nervously and physically, filled with despair, unable to see even a ray of hope. I had nothing to live for. I felt I hadn't a friend left in the world, that even my family had turned against me. One night, Dr. Eggleston gave me a sedative, but the effect soon wore off, and I awoke with an overwhelming conviction that this was my last night of life. Getting out of bed, I wrote farewell letters to my wife and to my son, saying that I did not expect to live to see the dawn. When I awoke the next morning, I was surprised to find that I was still alive. Going downstairs, I heard singing in a little chapel where devotional exercises were held each morning. I can still remember the hymn they were singing, "God Will Take Care of You." Going into the chapel, I listened with a weary heart to the singing, the reading of the scripture lesson, and the prayer. Suddenly, something happened. I can't explain it. I can only call it a miracle. I felt as if I had been instantly lifted out of the darkness of a dungeon into warm, brilliant sunlight. I felt as if I'd been transported from hell to paradise. I felt the power of God as I had never felt it before. I realized then that I alone was responsible for all my troubles. I knew that God with His love was there to help me. From that day to this, my life has been free from worry. I am 71 years old, and the most dramatic and glorious 20 minutes of my life were those I spent in that chapel that morning. God will take care of you. J.C. Penney learned to overcome worry almost instantaneously because he discovered the one perfect cure. I go to the gym to punch the bag or take a hike outdoors, by Colonel Eddie Egan, New York attorney, Rhodes Scholar, former chairman, New York State Athletic Commission, former Olympic light heavyweight champion of the world. When I find myself worrying and mentally going around in endless circles, like a camel turning a water wheel in Egypt, a good physical workout helps me to chase those blues away. It may be running or a long hike in the country, or it may be a half hour of bag punching or squash tennis at the gymnasium. Whichever it is, physical exercise clears my mental outlook. On a weekend, I do a lot of physical sport, such as a run around the golf course, a game of paddle tennis, or a ski weekend in the Adirondacks. By my becoming physically tired, my mind gets a rest from legal problems, so that when I return to them, my mind has a new zest and power. Quite often in New York, where I work, there's a chance for me to spend an hour at the Yale Club gym. Now, no man can worry while he's playing squash tennis or skiing. He's too busy to worry. The large mental mountains of trouble become minute molehills that new thoughts and acts quickly smooth down. I find the best antidote for worry is exercise. Use your muscles more and your brain less when you're worried, and you'll be surprised at the result. It works that way with me. Worry goes when exercise begins. I Was the Worrying Wreck from Virginia Tech, by Jim Birdsall. Now, 17 years ago, when I was in military college at Blacksburg, Virginia, I was known as the Worrying Wreck from Virginia Tech. I worried so violently that I often became ill. In fact, I was ill so often that I had a regular bed reserved for me at the college infirmary at all times. When the nurse saw me coming, she'd run and give me a hypo. I worried about everything. Sometimes I even forgot what I was worrying about. I worried for fear I would be busted out of college because of my low grades. I'd failed to pass my examination in physics and other subjects, too. I knew I had to maintain an average grade of 75 to 84. I worried about my health, about my excruciating attacks of acute indigestion, about my insomnia. I worried about financial matters. I felt bad because I couldn't buy my girl candy or take her to dances as often as I wanted to. I worried for fear she'd marry one of the other cadets. I was in a lather day and night over a dozen intangible problems. In desperation, I poured out my troubles to Professor Duke Baird, professor of business administration at VPI. The 15 minutes that I spent with Professor Baird did more for my health and happiness than all the rest of the 4 years I spent in college. "Jim," he said, "you ought to sit down and face the facts. If you devoted half as much time and energy to solving your problems as you do to worrying about them, you wouldn't have any worries. Worrying is just a vicious habit you've learned." He gave me 3 rules to break the worry habit. Rule 1, find out precisely what is the problem you're worrying about. Rule 2, find out the cause of the problem. Rule 3, do something constructive at once about solving the problem. After that interview, I did a bit of constructive planning. Instead of worrying because I'd failed to pass physics, I now asked myself why I had failed. I knew it wasn't because I was dumb, for I was editor-in-chief of the Virginia Tech Engineer. I figured that I'd failed physics because I had no interest in the subject. I'd not applied myself because I couldn't see how it would help me in my work as an industrial engineer. But now I changed my attitude. I said to myself, if the college authorities demand that I pass my physics examination before I obtain a degree, who am I to question their wisdom? So I enrolled for physics again. This time, I passed, because instead of wasting my time in resentment and worrying about how hard it was, I studied diligently. I solved my financial worries by taking on some additional jobs, such as selling punch at the college dances. and by borrowing money from my father, which I paid back soon after graduation. I solved my love worries by proposing to the girl that I feared might marry another cadet, and she is now Mrs. Jim Birdsall. As I look back at it now, I can see that my problem was one of confusion, a disinclination to find the causes of my worry and face them realistically. Jim Birdsall learned to stop worrying because he analyzed his troubles. In fact, he used the very principles described in the chapter, How to Analyze and Solve Worry Problems. I have lived by this sentence, by Dr. Joseph R. Cizu, President, New Brunswick Theological Seminary, New Brunswick, New Jersey, the oldest theological seminary in the United States, founded in 1784. Years ago, in a day of uncertainty and disillusionment, when my whole life seemed to be overwhelmed by forces beyond my control, one morning, quite casually, I opened up my New Testament, and my eyes fell upon this sentence, He that sent me is with me. The Father hath not left me alone. My life has never been the same since that hour. Everything for me has been forever different after that. I suppose that not a day has passed that I have not repeated it to myself. Many have come to me for counseling during these years, and I have always sent them away with this sustaining sentence. Ever since that hour when my eyes fell upon it, I have lived by this sentence. I have walked with it, and I have found in it my peace and strength. To me, it is the very essence of religion. It lies at the rock bottom of everything that makes life worth living. It is the golden text of my life. I Hit Bottom and Survived, by Ted Erickson. I used to be a terrible worrywart. No more. In the summer of 1942, I had an experience that banished worry from my life for all time, I hope. The experience made every other trouble seem small by comparison. For years, I'd wanted to spend a summer on a commercial fishing craft in Alaska, so in 1942, I signed on a 32-foot salmon seining vessel out of Kodiak, Alaska. On a craft of this size, there's a crew of only three: the skipper, who does the supervision, a number two man who assists the skipper, and a general workhorse who's usually a Scandinavian. I'm a Scandinavian. Since salmon seining has to be done with the tides, I often work 20 hours out of 24. I kept up that schedule for a week at a time. I did everything that nobody else wanted to do. I washed the craft, I put away the gear, I cooked on a little wood-burning stove in a small cabin where the heat and fumes of the motor almost made me ill. I washed the dishes, I repaired the boat, I pitched the salmon from our boat into a tender that took the fish to a cannery. My feet were always wet in my rubber boots. My boots were often filled with water, but I had no time to empty them. But all that was play compared to my main job, which was pulling what's called the cork line. That operation simply means placing your feet on the stern of the craft and pulling in the corks and the webbing of the net. At least that's what you're supposed to do. But in reality, the net was so heavy that when I tried to pull it in, it wouldn't budge. What really happened was that in trying to pull in the cork line, I actually pulled in the boat. I pulled it along on my own power since the net stayed where it was. I did all this for weeks on end. It was almost the end of me, too. I ached horribly. I ached all over. I ached for months. When I finally did have the chance to rest, I slept on a damp, lumpy mattress piled on top of the provisions locker. I'd put one of these lumps in the mattress under the part of my back that hurt most and sleep as if I'd been drugged. I was drugged by complete exhaustion. I'm glad now that I had to endure all that aching and exhaustion because it helped me stop worrying. Whenever I'm confronted by a problem now, instead of worrying about it, I say to myself, Erickson, could this possibly be as bad as pulling the cork line? And Erickson invariably answers, no, nothing could be that bad. So I cheer up and tackle it with courage. I believe it's a good thing to have to endure an agonizing experience occasionally. It's good to know that we've hit bottom and survived. That makes all our daily problems seem easy by comparison. I used to be one of the world's biggest jackasses. By Percy H. Whiting, author of The Five Great Rules of Selling. I've died more times from more different diseases than any other man, living, dead, or half-dead. I was no ordinary hypochondriac. My father owned a drugstore, and I was practically brought up in it. I talked to doctors and nurses every day, so I knew the names and symptoms of more and worse diseases than the average layman. I was no ordinary hypo. I had symptoms. I could worry for an hour or two over a disease and then have practically all the symptoms of a man who was suffering from it. I recall once that in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, the town in which I lived, we had a rather severe diphtheria epidemic. In my father's drugstore, I'd been selling medicines day after day to people who came from infected homes. Then the evil that I feared came upon me. I had diphtheria myself. I was positive I had it. I went to bed and worried myself into the standard symptoms. I sent for a doctor. He looked me over and said, "Yes, Percy, you've got it." And that relieved my mind. I was never afraid of any disease when I had it, so I turned over and went to sleep. The next morning, I was in perfect health. For years, I distinguished myself and got a lot of attention and sympathy by specializing in unusual and fantastic diseases. I died several times of both lockjaw and hydrophobia. Later on, I settled down to having the run-of-the-mill ailments, specializing in cancer and tuberculosis. I can laugh about it now, but it was tragic then. I honestly and literally feared for years that I was walking on the edge of the grave. When it came time to buy a suit of clothes in the spring, I would ask myself, should I waste this money now when I know I can't possibly live to wear this suit out? However, I'm happy to report progress. In the past 10 years, I haven't died even once. How did I stop dying? By kidding myself out of my ridiculous imaginings. Every time I felt the dreadful symptoms coming on, I laughed at myself and said, "See here, Whiting, you've been dying from one fatal disease after another now for 20 years, yet you're in first-class health today. An insurance company recently accepted you for more insurance. Isn't it about time, Whiting, that you stood aside and had a good laugh at the worrying jackass you are?" I soon found that I couldn't worry about myself and laugh at myself at one and the same time, so I've been laughing at myself ever since. Now, the point is this. Don't take yourself too seriously. Just try laughing at some of your sillier worries and see if you can't laugh them out of existence. I've Always Tried to Keep My Line of Supplies Open, by Gene Autry, the world's most famous and beloved singing cowboy. I figure that most worries are about family troubles and money. I was fortunate in marrying a small-town Oklahoma girl who had the same background I had and enjoyed the same things. We both try to follow the golden rule, so we've kept our family troubles to a minimum. I kept my financial worries to a minimum also by doing two things. First, I've always followed a rule of absolute 100% integrity in everything. When I borrowed money, I paid back every penny. Few things cause more worry than dishonesty. Second, when I started a new venture, I always kept an ace in the hole. Military experts say that the first principle of fighting a battle is to keep your line of supplies open. I figured that that principle applied to personal battles almost as much as to military battles. For example, as a lad down in Texas and Oklahoma, I saw some real poverty when the country was devastated by droughts. We had mighty hard scratching at times to make a living. We were so poor, my father used to drive across the country in a covered wagon with a string of horses and swap horses to make a living. I wanted something more reliable than that, so I got a job working for a railway station agent and learned telegraphy in my spare time. Later, I got a job working as a relief operator for the Frisco Railway. I was sent here, there, and yonder to relieve other station agents who were ill or on vacation or who had more work than they could do. Now, that job paid $150 per month. Later, when I started out to better myself, I always figured that that railroad job meant economic safety, so I always kept the road open back to that job. It was my line of supplies, and I never cut myself off from it until I was firmly established in a new and better position. For example, back in 1928, when I was working as a relief operator for the Frisco Railway in Chelsea, Oklahoma, a stranger drifted in one evening to send a telegram. He heard me playing the guitar and singing cowboy songs, and he told me I was good, told me that I ought to go to New York and get a job on the stage or radio. And naturally, I was flattered, and when I saw the name he signed to his telegram, I was almost breathless, Will Rogers. Instead of rushing off to New York at once, I thought the matter over carefully for 9 months. I finally came to the conclusion that I had nothing to lose and everything to gain by going to New York, giving the old town a whirl. I had a railroad pass. I could travel free. I could sleep sitting up in my seat, and I could carry some sandwiches and fruit for my meals. So I went. When I reached New York, I slept in a furnished room for $5 a week, ate at the automat, and tramped the streets for 10 weeks, and got nowhere. I would have been worried sick if I hadn't had a job to go back to. I'd already worked for the railway 5 years. That meant I had seniority rights. But in order to protect those rights, I couldn't lay off longer than 90 days. By this time, I'd already been in New York 70 days, so I rushed back to Oklahoma on my pass and began working again to protect my line of supply. I worked for a few months, saved money, and returned to New York for another try. This time, I got a break. One day, while waiting for an interview in the recording studio office, I played my guitar and sang a song to the girl receptionist, Janine, I Dream of Lilac Time. While I was singing that song, the man who wrote it, Nat Schildkraut, drifted into the office. Naturally, he was pleased to hear anyone singing his song, so he gave me a note of introduction and sent me down to the Victor Recording Company. I made a record. I was no good, too stiff and self-conscious. So I took the advice of the Victor recording man. I went back to Tulsa, worked for the railway by day, and at night I sang cowboy songs on a sustaining radio program. I liked that arrangement. It meant that I was keeping my line of supplies open, so I had no worries. I sang for 9 months on the radio station KVOO in Tulsa. During that time, Jimmy Long and I wrote a song entitled That Silver-Haired Daddy of Mine. It caught on. Arthur Satterley, head of the American Recording Company, asked me to make a recording. It clicked. I made a number of other recordings for $50 each and finally got a job singing cowboy songs over radio station WLS in Chicago. Salary, $40 a week. After singing there 4 years, my salary was raised to $90 a week. I picked up another $300 doing personal appearances every night in theaters. Then in 1934, I got a break that opened up enormous possibilities. The League of Decency was formed to clean up the movies, so Hollywood producers decided to put on cowboy pictures, but they wanted a new kind of cowboy, one who could sing. The man who owned the American Recording Company was also part owner of Republic Pictures. If you want a singing cowboy, he said to his associates, I've got one making records for us. And that's how I broke into the movies. I started making singing cowboy pictures for $100 a week. I had serious doubts about whether I would succeed in pictures, but I didn't worry. I knew I could always go back to my old job. My success in pictures exceeded my wildest expectations. I now get a salary of $100,000 a year, plus one half of all the profits of my pictures. However, I realize this arrangement won't go on forever, but I'm not worried. I know that no matter what happens, even if I lose every dollar I have, I can always go back to Oklahoma and get a job working for the Frisco Railway. I have protected my line of supplies. I Heard a Voice in India by E. Stanley Jones, one of America's most dynamic speakers and the most famous missionary of his generation. I have devoted 40 years of my life to missionary work in India. At first, I found it difficult to endure the terrible heat plus the nervous strain of the great task that stretched before me. At the end of 8 years, I was suffering so severely from brain fatigue and nervous exhaustion that I collapsed, not once but several times. I was ordered to take a year's furlough in America. On the boat returning to America, I collapsed again while speaking at a Sunday morning service on the ship, and the ship's doctor put me to bed for the remainder of the trip. After a year's rest in America, I started back to India, but stopped on the way to hold evangelistic meetings among the university students in Manila. In the midst of the strain of these meetings, I collapsed several times. Physicians warned me that if I returned to India, I would die. In spite of their warnings, I continued on to India, but I went with a deepening cloud upon me. When I arrived in Bombay, I was so broken that I went straight to the hills and rested for several months. Then I returned to the plains to continue my work. It was no use. I collapsed and was forced to return to the hills for another long rest. Again I descended to the plains, and again I was shocked and crushed to discover that I couldn't take it. I was exhausted mentally, nervously, and physically. I was completely at the end of my resources. I feared that I would be a physical wreck for the balance of my life. If I didn't get help from somewhere, I realized that I would have to give up my missionary career, go back to America and work on a farm to try to regain my health. It was one of my darkest hours. At that time, I was holding a series of meetings in Lucknow. While praying one night, an event happened that completely transformed my life. While in prayer, and I was not particularly thinking about myself at the time, a voice seemed to say, "Are you yourself ready for this work to which I have called you?" I replied, "No, Lord, I am done for I have reached the end of my resources." The voice replied, "If you will turn that over to me and not worry about it, I will take care of it." I quickly answered, "Lord, I close the bargain right here." A great peace settled into my heart and pervaded my whole being. I knew it was done. Life, abundant life, had taken possession of me. I was so lifted up that I scarcely touched the road as I quietly walked home that night. Every inch was holy ground. For days after that, I hardly knew I had a body. I went through the days working all day and far into the night, and came down to bedtime wondering why in the world I should ever go to bed at all, for there was not the slightest trace of tiredness of any kind. I seemed possessed by life and peace and rest, by Christ Himself. The question came as to whether I should tell this. I shrank from it, but felt I should, and did. After that, it was sink or swim before everybody. More than a score of the most strenuous years of my life have gone by since then, but the old trouble has never returned. I have never had such health. But it was more than a physical touch. I seem to have tapped new life for body, mind, and spirit. After that experience, life for me functioned on a permanently higher level, and I had done nothing but take it. During the many years that have gone by since then, I have traveled all over the world, frequently lecturing 3 times a day, and have found time and strength to write The Christ of the Indian Road and 11 other books. Yet in the midst of all this, I have never missed or even been late to an appointment. The worries that once beset me have long since vanished, and now in my 63rd year, I am overflowing with abounding vitality and the joy of serving and living for others. I suppose that the physical and mental transformation that I have experienced could be picked to pieces psychologically and explained. It does not matter. Life is bigger than processes and overflows and dwarfs them. This one thing I know. My life was completely transformed and uplifted that night in Lucknow 31 years ago when, at the depth of my weakness and depression, a voice said to me, "If you will turn that over to me and not worry about it, I will take care of it." And I replied, "Lord, I close the bargain right here."